When collared and released into the wilds of Northeast Oregon, Wolf OR7 took off on the run for the hills of Northern California. OR's epic 3,000-mile run leads us to ask, what is the lone wolf of California dreaming?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 906th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metroforum.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Hey, also got new guy in town, Dylan Thompson. Welcome aboard, Dylan. Going to be our intern here for a while, right?
That's right, Michael.
Okay, good. Now, was it Bob Dylan or Dylan Thomas?
My parents flip-flop. It's not.
Flip-flop. They don't know. Okay, well, welcome aboard. Dylan's working on producing shows for us, so it's going to be a fun time. University of California student. Well, folks, after being collared and released into the wilds of northeastern Oregon, Wolf OR7 took off on a 3,000-mile run to become the first wild wolf to inhabit California in 65 years. OR7's epic run through Oregon and northeastern California has been made famous by an ardent press and by a public that follows his wanderings via websites and Twitter feeds. One environmental organization even sponsored a kids' art and naming contest in which OR7 was given the user-friendly moniker of Journey. That being said, not everyone in California or the West is happy at seeing wolves running free. Some, in fact, see the wolf as being a direct threat to their livelihoods. Thus, the epic run of California's lone wolf leads us to ask, why did we release wild wolves into the American West? How do we mediate the conflict between those who want wolves to run free and those who do not? And finally, what is the lone wolf of California dreaming? Out there running around the hills all by himself with no other wolves to keep him company. Well, here to help us hunt for an answer, we have Karen Kovacs. Karen is the Wildlife Program Manager for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Karen, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, happy to have you aboard. Wildlife Program Manager, what is that? What do we do?
Well, in the State Department, of course, we have a new name change now. It is the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I oversee the wildlife program in the department's northern region, which is the northern nine counties of California. So my roles and responsibilities are to supervise the biologist as well as the department's lands and facilities, wildlife areas, ecological reserves.
Well, there's an interesting name change there. I wanted to go back to that if we might, because it's kind of like a sea change in how we go about seeing things. What used to be the California Department of Fish and Game is now the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thus, game, or that which we hunted, is now wildlife. And there's a significant difference in meaning there. Is there not, Karen?
Legislative change, so the department didn't advocate one way or another regarding the name change. Mm-hmm. But one has to keep in mind that although traditionally the department has provided opportunities for the consumptive user in California, it doesn't mean that we haven't all along the way also been responsible for all those other things that go on in the landscape, non-game, habitat, and the like. So the name change, my understanding is, was to better reflect the totality of what the department's roles and responsibilities are. It doesn't really change what we do.
Mm-hmm. But it does, in a way, change how we kind of see things, because what once was game is now wildlife.
Well, game was always wildlife. But I think you're correct, Michael, in the public's perception is much broader in what that means today than it did, say, 50, 60 years ago.
And so let's move on to this OR7 who came running into your domain here, what, last year, right?
You are correct. OR7 came into California back in late December 2011.
And to give us a little background on OR7, because OR means, of course, Oregon, and it was the seventh wolf to be collared and set loose in northeastern Oregon, which is...
You're correct. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, as part of their wolf management program, has made great efforts to collar wolves that now reside in the state of Oregon. Many of these animals, of course, have dispersed from other areas like Idaho. So these are wild wolves moving into Oregon. Part of Oregon's plan is to monitor the movements of wolves in their state. As part of that process, OR7 was captured and fitted with a radio collar when he was just a little bit over a year old. So the biologist up in Oregon, it did fit him with a collar back in February of 2011. Now, you're right. They also named him OR7 because he was the seventh wolf in their state fitted with one of these collars.
Mm-hmm. And that's how we keep track of wild wolves, right? I mean, they're kind of hard to follow around, so we have to keep track of them with radio collars.
It's a very effective way to keep track of whether it's wolves or other wildlife. The use of technology to follow wildlife movements has really helped us tremendously.
How long can you follow a wolf? I mean, how long does a radio collar last? Are they somehow hooked up to a solar grid or something so they last forever?
Well, I wish. It depends, but that's a very good question, and depending on what the purpose of putting a collar on a critter is about, you can actually structure the battery such that it can last a lot longer by transmitting data less frequently, or it can last a lot shorter if the data is transmitted more frequently. The collar that OR7 is wearing should last about another year. So a total of about 3 years of life is what his collar was designed for.
So this is pretty interesting. How long does a wolf live in the wild like that? What percentage of his life will be governed by this tracking device?
Well, if you consider that on average, wild gray wolves live between 5 to 8 years, this provides an opportunity for us to follow them for a considerable period of time.
So this is going to be pretty interesting. Now, Oregon has a wildlife program designed for wolves. What about California?
No, we do not.
Now, though, right?
Well, sort of. If you look at how Oregon planned for the eventual arrival of wolves in their state, setting aside funding, setting aside staff, they have dedicated staff that work on wolves exclusively with assistance from their other biologists out in the field. In California, while we did some initial background work, some homework, if you will, in anticipation of the eventual arrival of wolves in California, we certainly didn't expect a wolf to arrive that quickly. Funding is an issue in California with our department. We have taken on this issue of gray wolves in California with existing staff and existing funding. So we don't have any more funding to help us. We don't have any more staff to help us in this effort.
Well, this wolf is a very interesting one because when released with his collar, he left his pack and made a beeline for California. Kind of reminds me of myself, but I don't think this wolf was particularly listening to Jan and Dean's, you know, singing Two Girls for Every Boy. So, but a 1,000-mile beeline for California, what do you think he was looking for?
Well, you have to think about it from the perspective of biology. Most wildlife, young wildlife, disperse naturally. That's just part of the process. And OR7 was exhibiting common behavior associated with gray wolves. He's a young animal, going to go out and fend for himself, possibly find a mate or another pack, establish his own pack, pass on his genes accordingly. When you look at the social structure of wolves, typically in a pack, there's one dominant pair that reproduces, and they suppress reproduction in some of the in most of the subordinate wolves within that pack. So if you're a subordinate animal, like OR7 was, and you want to be able, you want to have the opportunity to pass on your DNA, the only way you're going to do that is if the same sex of the dominant pair should die, and you were able to assume that role, you get assimilated into another pack, or you find a single individual of the opposite sex and establish your own pack. So it's natural. It's natural behavior, dispersal behavior.
Okay, we're going to have to take a. Diane, we're going to have to take a. Or Karen, we're going to have to take a quick break here. But when we come back, we're going to pick up the lone wolf of California's search for a mate in a state that has no mates. Oh, my goodness. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, we're talking about the lone wolf of California with Diane Kovac, she of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Hey, and when we come back, we have Diane from Wolf Watch. Do stay tuned. Hey, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the lone wolf of California. Way back when, a couple years ago at any rate, OR7, Wolf OR7 was fitted with a radio transmitting collar and set loose in the wilds of northeastern Oregon, promptly headed out, 1,000-mile trek to California. Why not? That's what a lot of us did, right? But got to California and spent 2,000 miles looking for more wolves, but couldn't find any. So now there he is, the lone wolf of California. And he's become quite famous through websites and Twitter feeds and whatnot. And so we're picking him up and talking about him. But also we're talking about why on earth did we release wild wolves into the American West? And how, a lot of people like them, a lot of people don't. So how do we go about mediating that conflict between those who want to see them running wild and those who don't? With us we have Karen Kovac, wildlife program manager for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And also, we just picked up Diane Bentivania with Wolf Watch. Diane, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to the food chain. So give us a brief. What is Wolf Watch?
The National Wolf Watcher Coalition advocates for the long-term recovery of wolves. We inform the public about their value and the challenges to their conservation. And we support measures that promote their acceptance on the landscape, and we educate the public about ways that they can participate as an effective voice for scientific decision-making about them.
Fair enough. And I'm going to pick up a little bit our wild wolf who's out there running free. And Karen was talking about in the typical pattern of a wolf pack, the young male wolves get booted out right away, they being competition for the alpha male. And so the only way for them to fit in is that if the alpha male dies, or if they're assimilated into another pack, or if they run free and go out into the world and make their own way, I guess. And that's what Wolf OR7 did, and he headed 1,000 miles to California and then looked about California for a couple thousand miles to find a mate or find a new pack, and there aren't any because he's the only one around. So a little bit about a lone wolf. It would seem that wolves as being pack animals hunt one way. How does a lone wolf survive, Karen?
Well, you're absolutely correct. Gray wolves are social animals, and part of their success is their pack behavior to take down prey and support the pack. The odds of taking down large prey obviously are greatly diminished if the pack size goes down. And so OR7, we do know that OR7 is making a living out there.
He's a big boy, isn't he?
Well, he's probably about 100 pounds, we guess. He was collared when he was about 90 pounds, so we assume he's probably put on a little bit more since then. But wolves typically do take large prey, but it doesn't mean that's the only prey that they take. We know that they take smaller prey, rabbits. So they're opportunistic depending on what's currently available.
Did you ever read a book by a guy named Farley Mowat, Never Cry Wolf?
Well, I am familiar with some of that work, yeah.
It was kind of interesting because he talks about how the wolves were living on mice.
The wolves, absolutely. And when the population of wolves explodes and there's plenty of food available, I mean, you're going to take the path of least resistance and take advantage of that food source.
Mm-hmm. So he's, as a lone wolf, he's got to be a little bit tougher than a pack wolf, right?
Well,
it would seem.
You know, you're correct. But again, their sense of smell, their hunting techniques, their ability to cover great distances, their ability to use all kinds of different habitats and take advantage of those opportunities. We know that in all likelihood OR7 is mostly feeding on deer, but we have some evidence that suggests that he probably may have consumed some ground squirrels. And, you know, we've got jackrabbits. We've got other small critters out there that are clearly available for OR7.
So if he's taking down deer, he's a bad boy. I mean, he's a pretty tough guy then if he's a single wolf taking down ungulates the size of deer.
Well, you could say that, yes. Yeah.
Well, Diane, as you're out wolf watching, do you ever have an occasion to watch the behavior of lone wolves?
Not lone wolves, but we certainly do have the opportunity to see wild wolves in their natural habitat very often.
Mm-hmm. Are you up there in the Lamar River Valley of Yellowstone? Is that where you do a lot of wolf watching?
Absolutely, and actually we'll be there again very shortly in the coming weeks, and we're bringing more and more people to enjoy that opportunity, not only as a means of educating the public about wolf behavior in their natural habitat, but also supporting the many, many businesses around that particular area.
Yeah, it's become quite a tourist attraction up there in Yellowstone. That's for darn sure. But let me ask you this, Diane from Wolf Watch. What is it about wolves that city people find so fascinating?
Well, I don't think it's just city people that find them fascinating. Most environmentalists would pretty much celebrate the fact that the wolf is back in its natural habitat. They maintain the health and sustainability of landscape across the nation wherever they roam freely. They're a keystone species that have a disproportionately positive effect on the environment.
Then why are ranchers so frightened of them?
Well, because there's an issue that happens to be of growing concern regarding public lands grazing. And, of course,
public
lands grazing involves grazing cattle in wolf and wildlife habitat. And therein lies the beginning of significant conflict.
Okay. So there's the real worry then is from ranchers is that they will be shut off from the public from grazing their animals on public lands.
Well, not necessarily, because there are many proactive means to address the arrival of the wolf in its natural habitat. Many wonderful ways that they can coexist with them in a positive manner that will prevent a good deal of the conflict out on the landscape.
You know, when I first started doing, I'm on the 906th edition of the Food Chain, so a long time ago when I first started doing this program, I was doing a live radio remote broadcast from the kitchen table of a sheep rancher just on the outskirts of Yellowstone Park. And we were sitting in this kitchen table and all live on the radio, and we're talking about the wolf, the she-wolf, that was the alpha female, evidently, that was eating his sheep. She had a pack of cubs and to take care of, and the sheep were awful easy food source. So they were down there eating his sheep, and I was asking him about this whole phenomenon of releasing wolves, and he was scratching his head trying to figure out why it was being done. And just as we were in the middle of this conversation, the biologist who was responsible for releasing wolves into the Yellowstone ecosystem walked into the back door, and he had a tracking antenna in his hand, and he said, "She's back." And I had the opportunity to, you know, hey, sit down and talk with us. Why are you releasing wolves into the Yellowstone ecosystem? Are you trying to control the population of deer or elk? Well, no, he said. We're just bringing wolves back because city people want them back.
Well, that's really an exaggeration. I don't know specifically the person that you spoke to, but there has been documented evidence, scientifically documented evidence, that has proven the fact that wolves do resume a very important role in maintaining healthy wildlife areas.
Let me ask, Karen, do you see that?
Well, I think we need to broaden the perspective. And Diane is correct. There have been numerous studies done in the national parks relative to the changes on the landscape as a result of the reintroduction of gray wolves. But I think for us, particularly here in California, where you do have a lot of public land, you also have an awful lot of private land. And private land that supports livestock grazing, whether it's beef stock or sheep, there is that concern that we need to be cognizant of.
And Karen, can you hold on? We have to take a quick break, but I think we're right into the middle of our conflict. Do stay tuned. We will be back on the phones, 831-479-1080. Join us. Well, folks, here's a little story that my father-in-law told me about his grandfather, who was homesteading out in the prairies of eastern Montana. Hiked into Montana all the way from Canada on foot with his bride, and they built a home, a dugout home, you know, what they made with prairie sod. There were sod busters. They built a home out of sod, a little one-room cabin, and toughed it out there on the prairie, and they saved up enough to get some horses to make their work easier. And one night, wolves came, and the wolves chased away the horses, and the horses ran way back to the ranch where they were purchased, which was 100 miles away, so the grandfather had to hike 100 miles to get his horses back across the Montana prairie, leaving his wife alone in that sod house. The wolves came again, and the wolves surrounded the house, and the only thing grandmother had to protect her, to ward off the wolves, was pots and pans, which she had to bang away with all night. So picture her in that prairie sod house, banging away on pots and pans, because the big bad wolves are right outside the house. Now, we don't have any wolves outside our house anymore. We've all moved into town. We're no longer afraid of wolves. We don't know what they mean. But they're out there now, again. And I've had the opportunity to see them in the wild, to hear them in the wild. And there's some really big wolves out there, but we're not afraid of them anymore. So why aren't we afraid of big bad wolves anymore? Diane from Wolf Watch?
Because they're an animal, a wildlife, just like any other wildlife, that has its own particular role to play in the natural landscape. They serve a purpose, they're a positive influence on ecosystems, and they're one of many different kinds of predators out on the landscape that help to maintain biodiversity and a natural balance in nature.
Okay.
We welcome them.
Diane, here in California, we talk about, we look up to the Yellowstone ecosystem, and we see this giant parcel of land that, you know, the wolves can pretty much run free on, but not quite that way here in California. We don't have any big Yellowstone park for them to, you know, run around in as we do up there in Yellowstone. So we have a lot of private property, and I guess Wolf OR7 is, it must be running around on a lot of private property out here in California, right?
Well, in terms, if you're speaking about wolves' impact on ranchers, so to speak,
yeah,
we understand that many ranchers are opposed to wolf recovery because, like other predators, wolves do occasionally kill cattle. Many ranchers use, like I said, their own land and wild public land. But let's not forget that the USDA itself mentioned in its May 2011 statistics that less than a quarter of 1%, that's 0.23% of the American cattle inventory, was lost to native carnivores last year. So their direct impact on livestock inventory across the nation is basically negligible because there are other very far impactful ways that livestock are lost.
Mm-hmm.
Respiratory problems and digestive illnesses and calving problems and weather and disease and all sorts of other influences impact livestock inventory. And, of course, native predators, including native carnivores, have a very low impact, and that's based on USDA statistics themselves.
And, you know, when it gets right down to it, we kind of govern how much livestock we allow native carnivores to eat, too, don't we? We watch over that pretty closely. If we have a grizzly bear out there eating calves, you know, the grizzly bear is kind of shunted off into the back into the wilderness someplace. So we kind of govern that pretty closely.
Yes, and we do have agencies that, federal agencies that do address issues of repetitive depredation and other issues, but our organization is pretty much supportive of promoting education about peaceful coexistive measures that promote an opportunity for conservationists and ranchers to work together to protect livestock and save wolves through these kinds of non-lethal deterrents. They can use range riders and guard dogs to alert their herders about nearby wolves. There's portable fencing and flaggery that they can use to secure their livestock. There's non-lethal hazing techniques such as shining bright lights or firing a loud starter pistol, and just basic good animal husbandry practices such as removing carcasses of dead cows that attract wolves closer to their own herds of cows.
Mm-hmm.
These are all measures that are part of basic good animal husbandry in the 21st century.
And there you go. Maybe we can just all get along here. That's the idea.
That's the idea.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go to the phones and see what our listeners have to say. Folks, the phone numbers today are 831-479. That's 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. With us today, Karen Kovacs. She, the program manager for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And also with us today, we have Diane from Wolf Watch and you. So let's pick up and talk with Wendy. Wendy, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program. Wendy, are you there? Wendy. Wendy must not be there. So in that case, let's go to Maggie. Maggie, are you there? Uh-oh, I'm doing something wrong. What am I doing wrong? Well, we'll see. We've got our engineer coming in here, and we'll see what's going on. Diane?
Yes?
Do you ever have the opportunity to talk with ranchers about the wolves? Do you ever meet them one-on-one?
We do have the opportunity to meet with ranchers, and for the most part, we are very enthusiastic with the reception we have when it comes to discussing coexistence partnerships with them. Of course, we have some that are resistant, or I would hate to say the word resistant, but some that are speculative as to their effectiveness out on the landscape. But there are many proven programs already out there.
Mm-hmm.
There are programs that are promoted by Conserve Montana, or Defenders of Wildlife has a wonderful program up in Idaho, Keystone Conservation.
And you know, when it gets right down to it, Diane, you have the vote, don't you?
What is that?
Well, I mean, what I'm thinking is that city people really have much more of a say.
I'm not quite sure that we would characterize our list of supporters as city people. We represent a national organization of over 250,000 people across the nation, and I wouldn't characterize our supporters as all city people, no.
Okay. What percentage do you think are ranchers?
Well, we have a number of ranchers who are interested in sitting down at the table for productive conversation.
That's fair enough. Let's see what Wendy has to say. Wendy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, I can see a lot of those ranchers wanting to have the wolves in there because I have read the Barley Mow Op, Never Cry Wolf, and the percentage of rodents that they eat is incredible. And I think that In my opinion, and from my grandfather, who was a rancher, you lose a lot more stock from broken legs in rodent holes, and you have to shoot and put them down.
That's probably true, but in what it gets right down to, it's probably, you know, ranchers around throughout the West are losing very, very few when it comes right down to it. You're right
from
on
directly
that.
From the predators, but you know, a lot of broken legs out there from rodent holes.
Now, do you have a comment? Can you hold on with this?
Oh, certainly.
Okay, hold on. We're going to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Mike Lolson here. And you're invited to participate in this conversation about the lone wolf of California, as well as all the other wolves that are out there throughout the American West. And the phone number is today, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us. Should we let the wolves run free? Right back. Hey, welcome back to the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here with Karen Kovac. She, the program manager for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, formerly Department of Fish and Game. And also Diane from Wolf Watch. Holy smokes, we got a lot of wolf people here. Wendy, are you a wolf person too?
Well, I haven't ever seen one or heard one, so I haven't had that direct experience, but I am I do believe in having the predators out there, even though I'm a hiker, and, you know, sometimes that gets scary, but, you know, proper hiking, you know, you have pepper spray or you know, some kind of something to make a large sound to scare off that kind of...
Do you know how they tell the difference between a grizzly bear and a black bear in the woods? When they see the scat of a black bear, it has berries and stuff in it. And when they see the scat of a grizzly bear, it has cans of pepper spray. Just kidding.
That's a good one, though.
But really, what would you do if you were out hiking in the wilderness and was confronted by a pack of hungry wolves?
Well, I have to say,
you think
that
pepper spray would stop them?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
Okay.
But there is, I know there's different, you know, techniques you use if you don't have pepper spray, becoming very large and intimidating to a cat. Mm-hmm. Is what I've heard, and basically curling up in a ball and praying if it's a bear.
Diane, you've been out in the wilderness watching wolves. Have you ever found yourself alone facing a pack of wolves?
No, I haven't, because we recommend and we educate people to keep safe distances, and there are regulations in terms of when you're in a national park that we're supposed to maintain safe distances according to park regulations, but in out in the wilderness, of course, we follow those same kinds of good a good healthy respect for wildlife by maintaining distances in their habitat.
Fair enough. Wendy, do you have a follow up?
I was wondering, have you looked at the possibility, since you have these GPS, of having a rancher's app, since they do have, you know, issues with them?
Oh, to follow the wolf app? And yeah. and that's what I understand. Wolf OR7 is being followed via the internet, Twitter feeds, the works. Diane, do you have anything about this? Karen, is this wolf, do you have a you know, real-time tracking ability for this wolf?
We do, and on the Department of California Department of Fish and Wildlife website, we actually have a gray wolf link where members of the public can access the general location of where OR7 is on a daily basis.
Huh. Have you ever seen him?
I have not. A member of my staff has. In fact, the only known color published picture was by a member of my staff, Richard Shin, out in Modoc County. I've certainly seen his tracks and some of physical signs of OR7 on the landscape, but he has done a wonderful job of staying off the public's radar as far as the ability to see him or to hear him. So it's been quite interesting here. This animal has been in California for well over a year, and yet less than a handful of people have ever actually seen him.
He probably has very good survival instincts. And Wendy, thanks for your call. Really appreciate it. We're going to go to Maggie. Maggie, thank you for tuning in the Food Chain Radio Program. Welcome aboard. Wolf Conservation Center. What is that?
We are a education conservation organization. We are in South Salem, New York. not the city, so I don't know if you could classify as city people.
Well, wait a minute, does New York have wolves?
New York only has the wolves on our, at our facility, only captive wolves. We don't have wild wolves in New York.
We understand you have some wolves on Wall Street, is that true?
Yeah, I suppose, and that's one of the problems of wolves in our culture. But what we do at the Wolf Center is we do education, teaching people all over the Northeast and actually all over the world now with social media and our webcams about the importance of wolves in the wild. And we also house critically endangered Mexican wolves and red wolves. And as a pre-release facility, we house them, we have captive breeding, and we make recommendations as to which of these wolves should be released into the landscape.
Well, are you releasing wolves into the landscape of New York State?
No, actually closer to your neck of the woods, the Southwest, Arizona.
Okay.
And
you have them and you're breeding them in New York State and shipping them to Arizona?
Basically, we're part of a network, in North America between Mexico and the United States, of facilities that participate in the recovery of the Mexican gray wolf.
Okay.
So, I mean, right now there's, you know, probably around 50. Last official count, there was 58 Mexican wolves in their ancestral home of the Southwest in Arizona and New Mexico. And they are critically endangered species. And unfortunately, a lot of these guys are getting illegally shot and killed because it's such a toxic atmosphere out there when it comes to this natural piece of the landscape.
Let me ask you this. What's the size difference between a Mexican gray wolf and an Alaskan or a Canadian gray wolf?
The Mexican gray wolves tend to be a little bit smaller than their northern counterparts. I believe the average size is about 60 to 80 or so pounds. I'm not sure if Karen, what did you say the weight was of OR7 when he was last weighed?
Well, when he was collared as a yearling, he was 90 pounds. But I just want to correct you, Michael. It's not Canadian wolf as being any different. They're just gray wolves.
Just gray wolves.
Mexican wolves, red, that's correct.
Okay, so there's Mexican gray wolves, but no Canadian gray wolves.
Wait, they're just called gray wolves.
Okay, I have to take a quick break. Can you guys stay? We have a few minutes left. So much to talk about. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. A year or two ago, my wife Marlene and I were up in the Paradise Valley of Montana staying with some friends. And conversation got around to wolves. I think the conversation got around to wolves because they showed us a wolf pelt. And this pelt was of a magnificent animal, fully 7 feet from stem to stern. A huge, huge animal. And so we asked about them. Are they here? Where are they? Oh, yes, they're right up the hill there. Said, just drive up to the base of the hill at sunset, and you'll hear them. And so we did. We drove up to that base of that hill and had a couple glasses of wine on the hood of a car and the binoculars. We just sat there and waited. And within a few minutes, the wolves started howling and yipping and running, and you could hear them. And the sound was so magnificent, made the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And the cattle up and down the valley could hear them too, and they started lowing. Oh my goodness, the wolves are out. Fantastic sound. Well, so we wonder, where are we going to take these wolves? Karen Kovacs, what do you see the future of wolves in California being?
That's a great question, and clearly one of the challenges the California Department of Fish and Wildlife faces. And I think one of the, there's actually, I think, three separate issues that have clearly followed gray wolves since their original reintroduction into the greater Yellowstone area, and that's what are the consequences of restoring gray wolves on the landscape. There's the biological consequence, the social, and the political consequences, all of which we know is a huge challenge, and particularly for California, there's probably a greater likelihood as wolf populations continue to grow in Oregon, but it's very, very likely that dispersing wolves, other wolves, will follow OR7 into California. When that will be, we don't know. But those consequences and how we navigate through that process will determine how successful wolves may be on the landscape, whether in California but elsewhere in the West. The other thing that we also have to talk about is the financial impact. Is there is a strong desire to have wolves on the landscape, and thinking about it from the agency's perspective, who are charged with management of this particular critter, is it comes at a cost to these agencies, and depending on the public's desires, there also needs to be the financial aspect that comes along with it to hire staff to devote towards wolf management. So that's another challenge as well. But it depends on the public and the public's perception and their acceptance and to what degree.
Well, Diane, is the desire there?
I happen to believe the desire is there, and on two different fronts. One, of course, for the biological impact to the ecosystem, as well as one of the largest growing industries in the West, which is ecotourism. And, 72 million people across the United States this year were engaged in wildlife watching activities. And
we love to watch the wildlife, don't we?
We certainly do. And, of course, the mountain region and the Pacific region had the highest percentages of people who went out and did some wildlife watching.
Okay, Jack, you get the last word. What is it?
I just wanted to let you know that I actually have faced off with the gray wolf. I was working up in Alaska on a placer mine, and I took a bath in a creek, got out of the creek. I was getting mugged by mosquitoes, ran back into camp, and I grabbed a can of bug spray off the welding trailer, and I'm putting the bug spray on, and all of a sudden I hear it's woof.
And we're out of time, woof. And you got eight. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, everyone. This has been The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.